Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Abington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the War Report. And for those of you who are joining us for the first time, we welcome you as well. Today, we have a guest that I will introduce in a moment or two. This person is one of the few people who has really taken us into what it's like to be in a state, not just a district, but a state that is moving to become privatized at the state level. He provides us some tremendous insight of the who, the what, the why, the where, the how this is taking place. And he's a bird's eye view because he lives in the state, born, raised in the state, and has taught much of his life in the state. So he will provide for us the kind of view that we haven't had so far from a macro level, in that it's a state level phenomena that he's talking about, but also a micro level in that it's just one of the places that privatization movement is on the march. With that, the person that I'm talking about is none other than Dr. Doug Martin. Dr. Martin is a Whitman and language scholar, a poet, a musician, a teacher who has taught from kindergarten to graduate school. He blogs at the Bloomington, Indiana Common Erin and my fire dog blob. I don't know why I'm having a problem with that. Dr. Martin has wrote many exposés on the privatizing and dismantling of public education in Indiana. He has been a researcher. His research has been used by the FBI to do an investigation, and he has appeared on such things as ABC, or will be appearing, or his work will be appearing on ABC Nightline. He has been mentioned in Dr. Diane Ravitch's blog, mentioned also in Parents Across America, Charter School Scandal, and he blogs regularly at School Matter. And with that, I'm going to welcome Dr. Martin. Welcome, Doug, to the War Report.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Doug, you've got a very extensive resume here. I may have left off some things. For example, I didn't mention the fact that you have an MFA as well as a PhD. You want to tell us a little bit about yourself in that regard? Anything that I left off?
I have an MFA in creative writing from Bowling Green State University. At one point, it was one of the best programs in the country. I don't know what it's doing now. I had some success as a poet. I was a scholar at the Bread Loaf Writers Conference, which is in Vermont, and got to read at the podium where Robert Frost and a lot of great writers throughout the 20th century did, and published a lot of poetry. I had a book deal, a book-length poem that was scheduled to be published, and the printers backed out of it. Still write some poetry, not as much the last 3 or 4 years because I've been working on this book, but still have the poet in me, I guess.
Okay, let's say what that book is. The book is Hoosier School Heist. Many of you probably know about this book. It's kind of one of a kind, and I'll explain what I mean by that a little later, but Doug, also, before we start, I got to do a little housekeeping. There is a toll-free call-in number for those of you who want to call in and talk to Doug or ask questions of him or myself, and that number is 1-888-627-6008. Let me repeat. It's 1-888-627-6008. And, of course, we welcome and invite you to call in and talk to Doug while we have him at this point. So back to the book that you wrote, and it's a new book. This came out this year, 2014, and it's called Hoosier School Heist. First question that I want to ask you, Doug, is the name, the title itself. What does it tell us, and what do you want it to tell us? Naming and developing a title for our work is really a pretty big thing that most people don't realize the significance of. So if I'm correct in that regard, tell me what was the significance of the title that you selected for your book?
I struggled with the title for quite some time and had some help with the book's illustrator, Teresa Rosada. I believe she's probably the one that had the most influence on the title of the book. May have written a good majority of it. I can't really remember now. But I wanted to get, I believe I wanted to get the word heist in. That's the most important part of it, because I do see it as a heist. There are people who seriously believe in what they're doing. There's no question about it. They believe private companies can run schools better than government schools, right? There are people that seriously believe that, but I believe the most of the people behind the corporatization and privatization of the schools in Indiana and elsewhere are just, they're hucksters. They seriously are after the money, as Rupert Murdoch said. It's the last frontier of public treasure left in this country. I mean, we've privatized the water in places. You go to certain cities, you have to pay a private company to park in their public space. So this is the last frontier of how billionaires and these other people can cash in on taxpayers' dollars. And I tried to focus the book on the corruption and the shadiness behind all of it. As one reviewer said, I get down into the grass of all of it and start digging around. And once you do that, you can see how it all fits together. And it's not a pretty sight. It's full of deception, it's full of lies, it's full of misinformation, it's full of corruption, it's full of, as I say in my press release, people who have spent time in federal prison and a lot of people who should have. So that's where the heist comes in. I believe it's a deliberate attempt to steal public money and to de-skill the workforce, to get rid of whatever critical thinking skills are still left in public schools.
So then, what would you say was your premise, or some people would call it your theme, or the central question, or the central conclusion that you set out to write this book around?
Well, I wanted to see how it all fit together. The propaganda machine was a big part of it. The front groups, there's a lot of front groups involved, Stand for Children, the Friedman Foundation, the people who feed the media the information that the general public gets. I wanted to see how that all worked and how the deception fit in and who was connected to what group and what group was connected to another group. And it became quite a puzzle to put it all together, but it fit perfectly well, and it's obvious that a lot of people have spent money and time to do this. Whereas the people who are trying to save the schools tend to all do it for free. These people pay the very smart people a lot of money to do their dirty work, and that's why it gets done.
Well, my answer to that question, I said that the takeover of public education and schools by corporate state elite and their minions. By providing answers to the who, the how, the why, the where, the when, and the consequences. That was my take after having read the book as a way for me to be able to put all 154 pages into a basket, more or less, or a context. So I think you said pretty much what I said, but I just used different terminology. But the focal point, I believe, and what you were really trying to do, say the premise, is to, well, let's put it back in academic terms. When we do a research project, we start off with a premise or a theory of some sort, and if we're going to do an experiment to prove or disprove the accuracy of our idea, we develop a set of propositions, mostly around if A happens and then B happens, is there a relationship between A and B? And if C happens, is there a relationship between A, B, and C, and what is the nature of that relationship? I sort of put it in those terms because, in essence, what I see here is a tremendous, tremendous research effort that goes well into the who, the as I said earlier, the who, the how, the why, the where, the when, and the consequences by thinking better, I think. And again, I'm only saying I think because you're here on the other line, you can tell me if I'm right or wrong or not, but taking over public education in schools by the corporate elite, that was what I think, and how they're doing it is what I thought was the central question you posed to yourself and went out to answer. But anyway, am I anywhere close?
Yes, I think so, and I think that's why, I mean, I'm selling copies across the country, and I think one of the reasons why is it's a playbook. It tells the playbook how it's all put together. So if you're in a different state and you know absolutely nothing about what's going on, you can read this book and see some of the same players in your state, and then things that you read in the newspaper and see on TV start making a little bit more sense. You could read between the lines. I think that's what's the beauty of the book.
You know what? That's my next sentence. I said something to the effect that Indiana is a test case and a template. But that was under the question of my next question. Why should I or the public care about your book?
It's a serious wake-up call, and unfortunately, it's not being listened to as much as it should be. I mean, the book is selling, of course, and I go around the state and I talk, but there are people in Indiana who ought to be reading this book and paying attention, and they're not, and that is the Indiana Democratic Party. Now, I've sold books to a lot of the candidates who are running, and I've told them that, yes, if you buy my book, I will support you by digging through the campaign records of your opponent, and I will smear them as much as I can for you. So I've had a lot of people running on the Democratic ticket who have been very supportive, and I love them to death for it and for what they're doing, and I believe they're honest people. In terms of elected officials, there have been 3 elected officials who have bought it. 2 of them are my neighbors, and 1 of them hasn't paid me. I've sent out 80 emails to Democratic Party leaders across this state, 80 different branches of the Democratic Party. Until somebody tells them, hey, you ought to pay attention to this guy, and they're not going to pay attention. And these are the people that need to be paying attention. For one reason, it comes up in the book about John Gregg taking hedge fund money from the Democrats for Education Reform. And I was talking to someone recently. He said, well, John, you know, I know John Gregg. He didn't know what kind of money he was taking. I said, that is the point. If these people don't know who's on their side, who's against them, and who's corrupt and who's not, how are they going to function? I'm afraid a lot of this dirty money from New York City, from the hedge fund people, are going to come into the state, and the politicians need to be aware of who is on the public side and who isn't. And I think that's, as public figures, they should know this stuff. So I'm not too happy about that. I'm not happy at all. because the book was written to educate people. 6,000 hours I put into it at least. Then, you know, been promoting it on and on and on, and I think there's some people in high power in this state that need to be read this book. They need to be locked in a room for about a week and read this book over and over and over so they understand what they're up against. If they truly believe in Glenda Ritz and they truly believe in saving public education, then that's what they need to do. Until then, it's lip service.
Okay, what about the public? Why, again, as I, a member of the public, why should I care about your book and what you're saying in your book? I mean, you've answered it on a higher level in terms of a select group of individuals who are running for office or in office or who aspire for office, but me, the guy who lives across town from you, the guy who lives in upstate or downstate from you, why should I care about what you're writing about?
Okay. Let me follow up with what I just said, too, and then I'll answer that question. I think Republicans need to read this book, too. My understanding is when all these bills went through, it was basically Mitch Daniels in a room with all the Republicans threatening to destroy their lives, and I guess he's pretty good at it. And if they did not pass these bills, I'm sure there are a lot of Republicans out there who don't understand what they're involved in. If you can somehow get to them and explain to them, you might change some of it, too. Now, as an average, not average, but as a citizen, a parent, for instance, I think you need to know what is going on. Your kid goes to school and vomits over a standardized test. You need to know why that is taking place. First of all, a lot of people are making money off of these tests, as we all know. The tests go back to the eugenics movement. And we know how that gets translated into intelligence testing, and then it gets, you know, into the schools, and it gets shipped over to the Nazis. And once you start classifying people as this or that, you're running into serious implications too. So if you want your child to grow up and function as a well-thinking adult, you should know the people who are against this. They want to train your young son or daughter for a workforce that doesn't exist. One of the things they're looking for is to flood the job market with overqualified people so then they can pay them pennies. That's a big part of it. There is no skills gap. It's all a myth. It's been said since the 1980s. They've been saying the same thing over and over. It gives them cover to ship jobs overseas. There's no one here that has any jobs, so what do? We put them in prison. As a parent, you should be very worried about what's going on, and you should be very aware of it. As a community, just someone in the community without any kids, you ought to ask yourself, you know, I go to work every damn day in this country. I pay my taxes to the state, and what do? They give it over to people who they are either friends with or people funding their campaigns. And is that why I go and work 9-hour shift to put food on the table, to give my taxes to pay for this crony capitalism? I mean, people need to be upset about it. I know I am. I don't make a lot of money where I work, and I'm thinking this money is going to friends in the Indiana government or the federal government. Bail out the banks or whatever. The people that we put on TV are the ones that probably ought to, most, a lot of them need to be down the street here in the federal prison in Terre Haute, Indiana. And I tell this to Larry Bouchon, our congressperson in D.C., every time I ride him. If you want to create jobs in Indiana, Bouchon, expand the wings on the federal prison and put these people in jail.
I like that last part, expand the facility so that you could house the people. Nice. Anyway, another question which is related to this is my question of, you have been teaching for a number of years, as I mentioned, from kindergarten all the way up to graduate school. You're still involved in the education profession. What and when did you, well, let's start with when. When did you start to see that what was happening in Indiana was a movement towards privatizing education? or what I like to say, a movement towards destroying public education in order to be able to erect a privatized national, or in this case, a state-level education system.
Yeah, well, I started...
When?
It was about November 2010, I believe, was when I wrote my first letter that was published in the Indianapolis Star about Mitch Daniels' buddy, Dennis Baalke, who runs Imagine Charter Schools. And Baalke, as the book points out, was involved in the great IPACO AES merger in Indianapolis. Indianapolis Power and Light Company merged with Baalke's group. The stocks crashed. A lot of people lost money. The average workers lost money. The leaders came away with these parachute packages. The anniversary of the merger was the other day. I opened up the Indianapolis Star, and I was in Kokomo getting ready to be on a panel for the Rise Above the Mark event. They had a little note in history, and there it was. Oh, boy. So I started digging, trying to figure out what was going on, and I don't know how I put the pieces together. Unfortunately, in the world we live in, you have to do a lot of thinking and a lot of research just to function in our society. You can't trust people. You can't trust the media. You can't trust the politicians. So it takes a lot of digging. Look at the food we eat. Someone asked me a few months ago what food was safe to eat. I said, I don't know. Probably not much of it. But I haven't done the research. I haven't sit down and spent 6,000 hours trying to figure out what I ought to put in my body. But it's the same sort of deception. The people who are making the products are paying the researchers to do the research. The people who are doing the research are funneling it to the media. So you don't know what's going on. And that's what happened when I started digging into the school privatization movement, and I started putting pieces together, and I ran across the Parents Across America and Sharon Higgins' blog, Charter School Scandals, and Susan Ohanian's work, and then it all started clicking. And once it clicks, there comes a point where it makes perfect sense what is going on when you spend enough time studying it. And now, you know, I can just read headlines, and I don't even have to read the details. I just know, you know. I know before, if there was a story on TV, and they'll say, we're going to have a story about the schools, and they'll tell you what it's going to be about, and then they'll go to commercial. I don't even have to listen to the story. I know exactly how they're going to frame it, what they're going to say, and whose side they're on. That is propaganda. I don't know what else you would call it. So, yeah, I started putting it all together, and then it clicked, and then I was writing blogs, and I decided to put the book together. I was working on a book on the national level because I was more known across the country than I was in Indiana at that point, and I worked on it for maybe 6 months or so, and then I decided to focus in on Indiana.
Well, you just answered two of my remaining questions here. One, you now put 2010 as the date or time that you became aware that something was amiss.
November 2010, around that time, yeah.
And that's very interesting to me because it was 2010 that I became aware of what was going on.
Really?
I mentioned in my first show back in February that when I was teaching, and I'm taught mostly at the university level, that I didn't see, and my colleagues didn't see, that there was this movement afoot and what it was going to be like as a movement and what its goals, objectives were. We didn't see it. So therefore, I couldn't even expect for the general public to see it if we, quote, the experts in education, didn't see it. So for decades after I taught and after I left teaching, I was not aware of what was going on. I saw charter schools popping up. I'm here in Los Angeles. I saw charter schools popping up. News reports, as you just mentioned, about bad teachers, bad schools, and things like that, and hearing my neighbors and friends all talking about how bad the schools were and didn't want neighborhood schools because they were all so bad. And I started, for me, I started wondering, wait a minute now. We all, talking about the people that I know, we all went to public schools. And those, many of my friends were teachers. And I was, and they were saying, well, they weren't going to send their kids to public schools, which they went to and taught in. So I started asking people, how do you know that the schools are bad? And what do you mean by bad? What do you mean by bad teachers? And they couldn't tell me. All they could recite was, they're bad, because the media was saying that they're bad. My kid is not really learning a whole lot, even though he's getting, he or she's getting good grades, and et cetera. There was so much contradiction that I started looking into it in 2010. And it was then that I became, I think what I hear in your voice, appalled at what was going on, the attack that was taking place against public education, public schools, public teachers. And I started my research about the same time. Mine, I think, was September of 2010. So that's very interesting that continents apart almost, you and I come up with the same time period for which we start our investigation into what was happening to, I'm going to put, my beloved public education. Okay, with that having been said, let me ask this question of you, Doug. I want to know if what you were teaching and you were working in education, did anything happen to you personally and or professionally that more or less also alerted you or heightened your sensitivities to what was going on in public education in 2010?
No, most of the teaching I've done has been at the university level, but I've been, you know, I've subbed in the public schools. I work as a behavioral aide with special ed kids now in a alternative school that's run by the school corporation. These are the kids who have been expelled from their home schools for behavioral problems, and they ship them over to our class. So I didn't really, I haven't had any instance personally that made me aware of what was going on now. But you hear stories all the time from teachers about administrators and, you know, getting rid of people who are too old because they want to hire somebody younger, they want to teach for America, recruit, and, you know, put in their place. You hear those stories a lot, but nothing happened to me personally. No.
Oh. All right. The book, the 6,000 hours that you spent, the book. When you started out, what, again, was the objective? Can you, I mean, you've given us a portrait, but can you specifically say why you decided to write this book, and what you wanted this book to do?
Well, my first book is on Walt Whitman's prosody, which is a fancy way of saying poetic meter, rhyme, rhythm, sound patterns. I don't even know how many copies it sold, mostly to university libraries. And, well, I guess all of them were university libraries. I was digging around. I wanted to expand my knowledge, so I spent 7 months reading. I spent 7 months trying to figure out how to read neuroscience. So I did all this background research on neuroscience, so I could read the original neuroscience reports from, you know, brain scholars, and I was trying to tie that into the evolution of language. In the human race and the origins of language, which is a fascinating topic. I mean, it's just incredibly fascinating. So I started taking notes and doing that, and at one point I was going to write a mystery novel, so I decided to start researching psychopaths. And None of that panned out. I thought, I need to write something that somebody's going to read for a change. Everything I've ever written in the past, hardly anybody has read. In terms of my poem, I mean, no one reads poetry in this country. And so all my poems combined have less of an audience probably than one of my blog entries on school reform. But I think as a poet, I've always, and as a musician too, I've always wanted to express myself, and people express themselves because they want to be heard. We live in a society that doesn't listen to each other very well. And if you're outside of the norm, hardly anyone will listen to you. So I think there was that personal urge for me to try to get my voice heard in some way. And this seemed like the avenue for that. But it was also a way to educate people about what was going on. And it also tied in my scholarly skills, my research skills. And it also, in many ways, tied in the detective research I was reading about how you track serial killers and what makes up a serial killer and the sociopaths of the world. I mean, it all kind of came full circle. There's a lot of Doug Martin in the book, I think, a lot of different parts of what I have done in my life and wanted to do come together in Hoosier School Heist in different ways.
That is so interesting because I can relate to everything that you said later on, maybe not in this conversation, but throughout the history of this show. I will give a little bit more background of myself.
Yes,
but basically, I stopped teaching. I started saying, I've got all of this knowledge, all of this experience, and I've taught a lot of students, but I haven't been able to get to the larger stage that I wanted to get to. And as you just said, have my voice heard and my ideas and values expressed. So I looked around, and I decided to learn how to tell stories, fiction.
Yeah.
I spent several years studying, going to classes, seminars, and et cetera, learning how to write screenplays, novels, and sometime how to write a nonfiction book like your book, and et cetera. And in fact, I even got into this show because of that same urge of wanting to get out to the largest public I can. My understandings, my perceptions, and my interpretation of those perceptions of the world around us and where we are now and where we're going. So we share several things here that I didn't know. Of course, I wouldn't know because we had not met before. I have one last question in this vein, and that is, and you sort of like hit on it, but I want to see if I can narrow it down any further, and that is, what was your major or primary incident, if you can boil it down to that, that really pushed you to want to write this book? And let me give you some examples. Was it Common Core? Was it the charter school invasion in Indiana? School closure? High-stake testing? Vouchers? The undemocratic way that things were happening in Indiana, you want to say in Annapolis. Was it the overall war on publication and your realization that the war aim was to destroy public education in order to erect privatized education? Some specific concept, experience that pushed you more than anything else to write the book. Let me give you an example. For me, it was, as you said, first seeing the dots out there and then painting the dots for me and then the ability to begin to put them together. And it all spelled to me a war to destroy public education and erect a privatized education. The testing,
yeah.
The vouchers, the charter schools, Common Core wasn't there then, and all the other things that were happening, I was angry about. But it was when I finally put together, they're trying to destroy my public education. And I won't stand for that. And that started me on what has now been a four-year journey to defend and defeat those who want to destroy public education. That's what I mean by that question.
Yeah, I think it was the overall picture, but I also think it was just the scandalous nature of a lot of it. Sharon Higgins' Charter School Scandals website had a major influence on the way I looked at all this. If you go to that site and you read the newspaper articles that have been written about various tactics these people have used, it's just that's where the heist comes in. So I was interested in that, the sort of absurdity of all, how you hear somebody on TV talking about how this is great for children, and once you start looking behind the scenes, what's going on, it's a horror story. And so that site had a big influence on how I wanted to frame the book. There's an investigative reporter, I keep his name, Greg Powless, is that his name? Writes a lot about government corruption. His books had some influence on me. The whole muckraking things that were written in the late 1800s, early 1900s. I wanted to approach the book in that way, and the more I got into it and saw the details, the more I saw that. There are scandalous things in the book. There's no question about it. You got the FBI, you got the CIA in the book, you have child abusers, you have plagiarizers, plagiarists, and so it seemed, I mean, how could these people even be taken seriously? That's one thing I think people get from after they read the book that they're angry about, is it's such a scam, all this, and how can anybody take this stuff seriously when you read the book and you see the details of what has been taking place? It's the circus that you'll never see on TV or hear about in the newspapers. You'll never hear it. So that's what I was interested in. Of course, I know not every charter school is as corrupt as some of the stuff I mentioned in the book, but there are enough bad apples out there that it runs the entire bucket.
That is one of the... There are many,
use
many.
Use a cliche. I'm not much. I know I talk in cliches a lot more than I used to because I talk to different types of people than I used to talk to. But you know, so the poet in me just, you know, just had a big, oh my God, what did I just say that?
So should I call you Walt Jr.? No, Doug. I've read your book. I've heard you speak on other talk shows. I want to tell you, if you don't already know, I was blown away by your book. I was totally, absolutely blown away. And I wrote on my Facebook page, this was a must read for everyone. And let me give you some examples, you also the audience, some examples of what I'm talking about here. The book is a fantastic example of the best tradition of investigative journalism, even though you're not investigative journalist.
Yeah.
The book covers in detail from A to Z the whole picture of how the Hoosier school system on a state level, and I keep emphasizing that, we're talking here a state level. I don't think there is another state that this war is playing out on a state level as opposed to district by district level or neighborhood by neighborhood level. You cover a state. That's something that I have not seen in any great detail before. Very informative. Also, I'm doing a book review type thing. Also, and this is what struck me more than anything else, and to me, what I'm about to say, this is what sets your book apart from all the other books that I've read and that I know about, including the bestsellers out there, your book has spawned two investigations. You mentioned one, the FBI, and isn't there a state-level investigation also going on?
There's some things going on with the reform school that's in the book, yes. It's a long, complex story, but yeah, and I don't know. I think if people who know the law would read the book, maybe they can find other things they can dig up. So yeah, I've tried to make change as much.
Well, let me finish that statement that I was saying. For me, your book accomplished what I hope at someday I will be able to accomplish in one format or the other, and that is get people like the FBI, the public, aware and understand to the point where they take action, and in this case, the action being a federal investigation. I don't know of any other book that has launched such an investigation.
Well, I don't know if the book launched it, but the book was used. I know the book was used by the FBI in their investigation. The group, the Gulen Charter Schools...
Mention that investigation for people who haven't read your book.
It's about the Gulen Charter Schools. It's a group of Muslim people, and I don't want to paint all Muslims like this because they're not, of course. But it's a group of Muslims that are based in Turkey. The person who is the head of this group is Fethullah Gulen, who lives in exile in Pennsylvania. And the FBI raided these schools back in 2011, and it disappeared. I know I had contacted the FBI in 2011 and asked them if they could comment on anything, because I was a writer and I was planning to do the research on this group. And they emailed back and said they really couldn't comment. I'm sure they probably were reading some of the stuff, because I was writing a lot. They're probably reading a lot about this group. The group that they just raided is the Concept Schools version. It's one of their branches of the Gulen movement. And they are in Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, and a few other places, I believe. But I know for a fact that the FBI has read my book, at least that section, and I told them to read a few other things in the book, too. I know that they have. I mean, I know that personally. So I don't know how big of an influence I had on I'm having on any of this, but it's better than having none at all, I guess. So, yeah. So, but no, I can't take complete credit for that, but I mean, I can say that hopefully it has helped them.
So I just have given you national credit for this. I'll take the heat for that.
I think there's a lot of other people that you can thank for that too, yeah. Sharon Higgins is one of them, yeah.
The Gulens, are, as you just mentioned, are still very much active in terms of federal investigation. If you take any of the education blogs, you'll know that almost every week in the past 4, 5, 6 weeks, there's been a story about the Gulen investigation. But anyway, the point that I wanted to make was that the book is that good that it has an impact beyond just the choir, beyond just us teachers and parents and et cetera, that we need in order to make any serious effort to defend public education. So to me, that's a major contribution that I'm attributing to you here.
Yeah, and I think one of the big things I did play a part in is getting one of the state board members removed from the state board a few years ago when I discovered that she pretty much copied major sections of her PhD dissertation. And I have to thank the Journal Gazette, the Fort Wayne Journal Gazette, Karen Francisco, and the reporters there for writing about it, or it would have been covered up. There's no question about it. Daniels and these people were going to make it go away. That story may not be over yet. I am trying to dig into more things that about what went on. I don't know if I'll be successful or not, but I'm hoping it does not go away. She eventually stepped down from the board, disappeared, and it was never announced until Karen Francisco discovered that she had been removed. I don't know if Daniels kicked her off or she resigned or what really went down with it, but there was no question about that. I played a big role in that.
See, your investigation, there are other people who claim to have PhDs, claim to have experience that they don't have, who are in very high places in terms of positions in either being principals, being superintendents of schools, and et cetera. And there's been some investigation of their degrees and the quality or the authenticity of their preparation to earn the degrees, but none of them, except for one in, was it Connecticut, where someone was just outed as not having the PhD that he has said he
had.
Yeah,
I saw something about that. Yeah,
and the governor there was one of his, supporters, Malloy, and now this person has. Oh, not only that, he also had a criminal record and for fraud. And so he, this past week or last week, resigned. And now there's a wider investigation on other people, possibly, who have questionable credentials, who have been presenting themselves that way. Here in Los Angeles, our superintendent of schools, his PhD has been questioned. In terms, I think he got a PhD in over just a matter of hours, per se, as opposed to the 3, 4, 5, 6 years that take most of us to earn our degree. But your work led to, or contributed to, the FBI. That's, to me, that's a big thing. That's really big. I won't beat that horse anymore, but that's a big thing. And before we conclude, it was the last page or two of the book that I want to leave the audience with. Can you turn to page 152 to start with?
All right, I'm there. Yeah, I have it.
Since it's your book, where it says, where it starts at the bottom, where it says, school is a small town, not
yeah.
a... Compass Town. Can you read that for us?
The school is a small town, not a company town. In a society where government-embedded corporations run schools and Jesus is painted as a Milton Friedman crusader, the bottom line becomes more important than children, as it has in Indiana. By reducing kids to commodities and parents to buyers, corporate schoolers stress that teaching young children to spurge on material objects is a main educational goal. School privatization diminishes teachers, parents, students, and education to something someone can sell and make money from, and it eliminates any quest for knowledge's sake. If the corporate school assault is not stopped and we still have a public school system left, the best we can hope for is that children of the labor class will be trapped in for-profit public institutions where teacher turnover is high, legislated by a new world business order where class division is applauded as a natural standard. Public school students will be left with only faulty measurements like test scores to dumb them down, and classes targeting the workforce or one sending them off to drown in student loan debt, unable to find employment after college. If they can find a job at all, overworked teachers and for the long haul will be paid less and incessantly worried about becoming the latest victims of faulty test scores.
Let me stop you there. That, to me, was the essence of your book. You started us off with the goal of, identifying the problem, the players, the relationship between the players, what they were doing, where they were doing it, when and how, and et cetera. And you end by bringing it all together in those few paragraphs, for me at least. And I looked at it as saying, what I see here is your vision and warning of the future. And your plea for us, the public, as well as those of us in the ed community, to wake up and smell the napalm, more or less, and start doing something about it. I thought it was one of the most succinct encapsulation of everything that I've read over the last 4 years. And that's why I saved it for the last, and I wanted you, the author, to basically express it in your own words, verbally, as opposed to me doing it. And I was, again, many parts of your book blew me away, but this was perhaps the most salient for me. On the next page, on page 154, where you talk about Kathleen Stewart, that also got me and was a great way to close out your book. Can you read that for us?
Okay, 154, yeah. Okay, the power and success of a few greedy people are destroying the lives of the rest of us and our children and grandchildren. Corporatists and wealthy theocrats have no sense of responsibility to anyone but themselves and their government friends. And although America probably will never develop into a holy Christian right free market nation as some on the religious right want, we are quickly sliding into a fascist country where the corporations and the government are one. The top Hoosiers, Eugene V. Debs and Theodore Dreiser, railed against 100 years ago. As Catherine Stewart writes, we may well find in a future world where the rich have their own system of education, the religious have theirs, the poor don't get educated at all, and everyone is schooled in contempt for those who are different, that we have kept all of our rights, yet lost everything but the pretense of democracy. This is where we stand or fall, where we truly stand for children, not hedge fund managers. If we don't stop the corporate government theocratic forces heisting a little bit of democracy we still have left in education in Indiana and in America, we are in deep, deep trouble.
That says it all. That says it all for me. And that is the quintessential purpose of the show. And my first broadcast, I stated my goals were to help create awareness, especially where none existed, and to give a more accurate picture where little awareness existed or misinformed awareness, to then move from there to understanding, and then from understanding to appreciation of what is going on, an emotional coming together of all of this, with the hope that those three, on a critical level, awareness, understanding, an emotional reaction to what one has become aware of and has now developed critical understanding, would move us as a people to take action to defend public education and to defeat the forces that are trying to destroy it. I think, Doug, your book, as I have said several times, comes so very close to what my show is about, and to a considerable extent what I'm about, and my own passion, as I heard in your voice, about what's happening to public education. And I'll go one step further. While you took Indianapolis or Indiana as a microcosm to thoroughly analyze it, break it apart, put it back together so that people could understand what was going on, it was also a warning to the larger 49 states that make up the U.S. But I also say it's also a warning to the rest of the world, because what's happening there in Indiana is happening around the world.
Oh, yeah.
The corporate elites are moving to take over public education as a public institution. And the motivation, as I see it, I'm not as kind as you are in terms of some people having great, pure motives in terms of what they're doing in this war to bring about, quote, the corporate reform agenda. I see it that here in the United States, education from K or pre-K to PhD is estimated to be a $1.2 to $1.5 trillion annual budget.
Yeah.
Worldwide, it's estimated to be anywhere from $6 to $7 trillion annually. I see what you did in breaking this down on a state level as a micro, as a macro. I work on the larger level, the macro level. You did the micro level here. But then the ability to travel from micro to macro and macro to micro, yeah, in order to try and put out that warning that is so desperately needed. So for that, sir, I don't have many heroes, but you have become one of my heroes.
Well, thank you,
James. I love your scholarship.
I know you work very hard, too, so you're my hero, too, because I've had conversations with how hard you work. So, yes, I respect you immensely.
Your scholarship, your scholarliness that I see and I appreciate and respect, and your book, I truly love your book. And having the opportunity to have you on the show and be able to spend an hour with you as opposed to 3 minutes, 15-second sound bites has been a highlight for me. And I hope for the audience that we have today. Anything that you'd like to say in closing?
Well, I think this all speaks to a lack of spirituality in this country on many different levels. We live in a materialistic society where everybody cares about the almighty dollar, as Eugene V. Debs once said. So that's, you know, when you're only concerned about money, that's where you lead to. I mean, a lot of talk about God, but this is not the God that I understand they should be talking about. So, yeah, a lack of spirituality in America.
Oh, that's one thing that I wanted to bring up that I didn't, is that you talk about the religious right and their role in the privatization movement. Not too many people talk about the religious movement in this whole war, as if it's taboo to some extent. I only know of one other. It was a chapter in a collection of articles. The book is The Assault on Public Education. People out of Chicago mostly. You know, I think University of Chicago, University of Illinois, that Chicago Circle, wrote in, I think, 2012, a beautiful article on the role of the religious right in the new corporate reform.
Yeah, I think I might have seen that.
And so to see you writing extensively about it, I was, again, impressed with what you have done and all. Well, Doug, I want you to stay with me for a minute. I want to do a couple things that I've never done before on the show. And the first one is, there is an organization, a pretty large-sized organization, called Stop Common Core in New York State. They are extremely active in trying to shut down Common Core at the state level and the various county levels and et cetera. And I've been following them on Facebook, and one of the things that I'm very impressed with is how active they are and how extensively they get involved. And I decided that I wanted to more or less sort of like give a shout out to them and particularly, they do something almost every day of the month, this group. This group is divided, I think, I'm going to say, in county subdivisions. They have a website or also a Facebook page called United to the Core. No, United to Counter the Core. And they have a community calendar that they list all of the things that they're doing throughout a given week, throughout the month. And so I'm saluting them for their activism and want to make others aware. I'm sure those who are on Facebook and who are engaged in our battle to save public schools maybe are aware of the larger group in terms of the Stop Common Core for New York. But I want to bring a little attention to the maybe the smaller group and the fact that they have this marvelous calendar that they report daily what they're doing for the month so that people can be aware and come out to various meetings and events and et cetera. Wanted to do that for the group, and the person who I think is responsible, at least for that, got my attention, is a Miss Loy, and if she is listening, I wanted to bring that out. Loy Gross, L-O-Y-G-R-O-S-S. I salute you and your group. We need everyone to be as active as you guys are. I want to say something else that came to my attention yesterday. There's a little five-year-old named Danny Nickerson. He is battling an inoperable brain tumor. He has a birthday coming up. I'm getting a little teary-eyed here. This month, the 25th, 5 days from now. And he, oh God, I don't even know how to say the rest of this. He gets great joy out of seeing his name, because he now can recognize his name and knows that that's what people are talking about. And his mother has expressed that he loves to get postcards. And for his birthday, it would be a great thing to send him a birthday card with his name on it so that he could read his name and to know that people are aware of him and what he's going through. And I'm sending him a birthday card tomorrow, first light. And I've sent out email requests to friends of mine to do the same, to let Danny know that we are pulling for him. The sad statistic that he's confronted with is that most kids his age, they die within the first 18 months of the disease. He's made it to year 5, and his mother's saying that he's still doing well. So, I would love for everyone who's listening to do the following. Send Danny a birthday card by the 25th of this month. Also, send out email requests, Twitters, Facebook, whatever, to friends and ask them to send out birthday cards. I would love to see us flood Danny with hundreds of cards. With that, I will say goodbye for today. I'll be back in 2 weeks, and I will announce, maybe on Facebook or what have you, some of the upcoming topics that we will be covering, and so that you'll know what our future looks like. I want to stop rambling at this point because Danny's story has me a little upset. So with that, let me say goodbye. Doug, you still there?
Yeah.
Let me say goodbye to you as well. And hopefully you will send Danny a birthday card.
Yeah, I'll email you so I can get all that information. Thank you. Oh, let me do that. Thanks for reminding me.
Yeah, okay.
Here's the information, people. God, I almost blew the whole thing. Danny. It's Danny, D-A-N-N-Y, Nickerson, N-I-C-K-E-R-S-O-N.
Okay.
P.O. Box 212, Foxborough, F-O-X-B-O-R-O, Massachusetts, abbreviated M-A, zip code 02035. Let me repeat that. You can mail it to Danny, D-A-N-N-Y, Nickerson, N-I-C-K-E-R-S-O-N, P.O. Box 212, Foxborough, F-O-X-B-O-R-Y, M-A, Massachusetts, 02035. Let's do this, people. Doug, thank you.
Thank you.
You and I will be talking, and hopefully you will be back on the show soon. So
great.
With that, I'm saying goodbye, Doug, and goodbye, audience. Doug, you can say goodbye as well.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.